Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Good evening and welcome to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. You're with Talk, we're on TV, we're on radio, we're online, and of course we're on your smart speaker as well. Coming up, back on track, Labour vows to renationalise the railways if it wins the next election. Smells like teens on spirit. England has more underage drinkers than any other country in the world. Brilliant. Oh crikey, fans of the 1980s family sitcom Terry and June hit out after TV bosses slapped trigger warnings on the show. Good evening, Britain, and welcome to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham, right here on Talk TV. Tonight, we dive into the gripping stories that are shaking up the headlines. First up, controversy reigns as the first deportation flight to Rwanda is announced on the very day Rishi Sunak's divisive bill takes effect. Then, shocking news from New York as Harvey Weinstein's landmark 2020 rape conviction is overturned, sending shockwaves through the Me Too movement. And if that wasn't enough, a century-old mystery unfolds as a long-lost Gustav Klimt painting resurfaces, fetching a staggering £26 million at auction. Buckle up for 2 hours of insight, intrigue and, of course, undeniable drama right here on Talk TV. This is the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. All aboard the Starmer Express. Anyone? Keir's here with a Labour pledge to renationalise the railways within 5 years if they win the next election. Under its blueprint, a new body called Great British Railways, which would take over service contracts currently held by private firms as they expire in the coming years. So your commute might sound something like this.
This is a Starmer Express service to renationalisation. Calling at £2 billion a year savings. Automatic delay and cancellation refunds, digital season tickets, integrated timetables, and better internet. Please keep your belongings with you and enjoy your journey. Could customers please be advised that the pay dispute with striking train drivers is ongoing?
Sounds a bit like the Johnny Cab, doesn't it, from that old Arnold Schwarzenegger film. Anyway, oh yes, that old chestnut, how the party, of the trade unions will handle the rail unions is still up for debate. Joining me now is transport journalist Dan Harvey. Dan, very good evening to you. Welcome to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. It all sounds great, doesn't it? Like the whole idea of the train system that we currently have all sounds great until you actually try and get on one. So how realistic do you think this is actually going to be for Labour?
I think it's a common sense idea when you remember that actually at the moment the railways are partly nationalised. You've got these train operators that are running trains under really strict prescriptive contracts with the government, where basically the government is telling them what to do and they're not really adding very much value to the whole operation, but they're getting a fee to run our train services. Yeah.
Well, they're getting quite a hefty fee, aren't they? I mean, they're all making loads and loads of money, the people running the train services. They're not running very well. They're not sorting out the striking workers very cleverly. And in the end, I'm afraid, they've also got the Network Rail problem, haven't they? So what are Labour going to do about that? Because one of the things that people say to me is the issue is that you've got Network Rail that sort of own the track and you've got all these different train companies that rent the track off them and run trains or not on somebody else's track.
This is it. I mean, a railway consists of the track and the trains running together, and one without the other isn't really much use to anybody.
Yeah.
So if you've got any sort of division between the two, where they're kind of having to liaise with each other, and they're having to make sure that they're meeting different contract terms, then that's creating a difficulty which doesn't need to exist. So I think, you know, the existing government has realised that bringing together the trains and the track, actually, you know, it's the only way that you can get the system to work. And what Starmer's said, what the Labour Party are planning to do is really just to push this forward a bit and say, yeah, well, actually, we don't need to have private train operators. We can bring the whole thing together. We can run it as a single unit, track and train together. And yeah, that makes a lot of sense, really.
But the thing that most people, I suppose, would care about who travel by train, and not that many people do anymore, unfortunately, is will it make this travelling on trains any cheaper? Because it's got quite expensive over the years.
Well, it is. I mean, it's hugely expensive, and the amount of money that has to go into to prop up the system is vast when you start picking away at it. I think you shouldn't be under any illusion that the plans that have been announced by Labour aren't going to suddenly mean the cost of travelling plummets. You know, there's a lot of work to do to streamline the system, to reduce these costs, to get it running more efficiently. And actually, those savings aren't going to be seen for years to come. So they're doing the right thing, but it's going to take time for the benefits to show.
Yeah, how long do you think, though? Because I remember when nationalisation was a big thing back in the 70s. The trains were pretty awful then under nationalisation. So what will they do to change that? How will they make that different?
Well, I don't think an awful lot is going to change. I think the existing operations, as the contracts expire, they will be bought back under government control. But the people actually running the system isn't going to change very much. But what it will do is it will get rid of this fee that you have to pay a company if you're asking a company to do anything for you, even if they're just in name running the railway. And it will also get rid of this clunky interface where there's a contract, and therefore if anyone breaks some sort of term in the contract, you've got to bring the lawyers in. So by getting rid of that, train tracks, they can work directly with each other without worrying about upsetting anyone. And in time, that should start to take out costs. It should start to make the whole thing much more efficient. But I don't think we're going to see a return to the sort of old nationalised days where British Rail was you know, much maligned, and there was the sort of British Rail sandwich that became the stuff of legend.
Yeah.
I think the actual standard, you know, that's not going to change. You're still going to have the standard we've got today, and hopefully, if Labour go about it in the right way, they'll be able to improve things.
Okay. Dan, thanks very much indeed. Dan Harvey there with an update on how they're not going to change anything. They're just going to hope that it gets better by the sounds of it. But you never know. You could well be onto something there. Let's bring in my panel. Comedian commentator Steve N. Allen is here. Communications Officer, Institute of Economic Affairs, Reem Ibrahim. Good to see you. And broadcaster Sam Dowler, welcome. So all of you. Now, I don't know how many of you use the train on a regular basis, but all I know from people who use the train on a regular basis is that they never know when the train's going to come. If it does come, you don't know how many carriages it's going to have. Don't know whether you're going to be able to get on it. It's going to be crammed and rammed. You're going to probably
have
your
face
up against somebody else's face if they're not on strike.
But this is why it's a good time to do this. Like, there's never been a better time. Because you literally couldn't make it worse. If you take over the train system now...
you say that.
Well, I do say that. So if you speak to anybody before the 90s that used the train service, they will be able to tell you that it was much worse.
Yeah, but there's no guarantee that it will go back to the same. Because all of the complaints about what could happen are already happening. All of the upshot of having a competitive market don't seem to be there.
Is it currently a competitive market is the question. The government are picking and choosing which companies get each leg, and effectively you've got to do a lot to not get that contract if you're the incumbent. If you fail, let's talk about what the market is. The market allows for competition and choice. As passengers, do we have a choice about what company we go with from London to Manchester? No, the government chooses for you. These are not the aspects of a market that we actually want.
Well, there's no point privatising something into no market. The same's true of water as well. If you can't actually have competition, you won't get efficiencies, no savings.
But you can have competition. Yeah. And actually, what
the point is, the trouble is, though, there is not only is there not any competition, but it's also not really privatised. It's massively, subsidised by taxpayers' money, and we give loads of money to these train companies who don't do the job very well, and who go and buy new villas in Florida.
But if we're funding a failing system, wouldn't it be nicer if we owned the failing system rather than someone else?
Well, no, it's clearly,
the government are going to be better at doing it than private companies?
It's clearly time for a change. It doesn't work. I rely on the trains.
Let's hear some examples of how bad it is.
I come from Hertfordshire, and I rely on the trains. I can't just drive into central London. I rely on the
trains. So are you on a main line?
Yes, on a main line. Right. Yeah, on Thames Link. No, not Thames Link. Actually, great. Well, you said we'll talk about that after. What I'm saying
so
is,
you don't even know what line. They don't even know what line it is.
To get a ticket and a zone and a zone 1 to 6 cost me £25.
Right.
And like, so for example, my
is that
friend,
return?
No, family, yeah, return. Right. Family of mine came over from Australia, and like anyone who comes to the UK sees that price, and they're so appalled about how expensive it is. And yet, so I also have family in Devon, and they go, oh, use the trains. And it's at least £200 for me to get down to Devon and back.
Yeah.
Where in the car, it cost me maybe 50.
Yeah. So, if there's more than, you know, if there's two or three of you.
Of course, it's ridiculous. Exactly.
But this is why, when they strike now, the main body of use of the trains is at the weekends, because most people now don't commute by train, either because they don't go to work anymore because they work from home, or just because it's become too expensive. Yeah. And they've found other ways to get in.
And they're not reliable. And that's fine if it makes you late for some personal thing, but if it impacts your career, it's very difficult to be booked for work.
But
and
no,
try
if you're,
and get
well,
trained.
Well, also, if you're trying to get to a hospital appointment or something like that and the train suddenly gets cancelled, it's horrendous.
And we know that if you miss an NHS appointment, you're not going to get another one for another 6, 7, 8
months. But also, I've relied on the train to get to live television like we're on now. And and as simple, even like 15 minute or like a cancellation, that means you're not there on time.
Right.
You do miss your work. And you have an empty chair here.
I mean, I've seen, mostly I don't use the train. In fact, I stopped using the train to go down to Sussex and bought a car because it was so unreliable. And that was years ago, right? But also the underground now, you see an awful lot of stations shutting. I drove home the other day past Bermondsey Station and it was 10 o'clock at night and it was shut. And it had a sign up saying, shut due to staff shortages, which means basically nobody's turned up for work.
Can't run the train because we don't have staff to get on the train. That's what we have.
This is TfL, which is, again, wholly owned by the government, and that's primarily Sadiq Khan's fault.
Yeah,
right? The tune does run pretty well, if you're going to make a comparison. Over the last few years, Sadiq Khan has bankrupted TfL not once, not twice, but three times post-pandemic. So I think it's really
interesting. Well, he's also found loads of money to keep him going, though, hasn't he? That's the other thing.
Our money that we're paying towards.
Yeah, no, I get that. But what I'm saying is the tube is not a great example of a system that doesn't work. And it works better than the rails.
It works actually really well.
But also, in defence of the people who don't turn up to their jobs on the tube, they were probably stuck on a train.
Possibly.
They would have been there if any of these trains actually ran.
Yeah, well, of course, if I was running it, I'd say you can't live outside of London if you work on TfL because we're not going to pay for you to come in. Mm-hmm. We're not going to pay for you to work while you're commuting, which is what they currently do.
Yeah.
It's an absolute racket.
It's your sales pitch for
exactly. And I have friends that live in.
I do it for less than £750,000 a year as well.
I have friends that live in Margate, which is only
very trendy now.
Yes, obviously trendy.
Very trendy.
Friends of mine.
I had a friend that moved there before it was trendy.
Of course you do.
Yeah.
Well, my friends are far more trendy.
I'm sure
that. However, they have jobs in London, and like it costs maybe like £10,000, £15,000.
Don't move to Margate if you're working in London.
You can't commute. That's absolutely outrageous to spend that amount of money.
Yeah, but think about the amount of childcare sometimes. House prices are in London. It's pushing people out.
But that's always been the case. People used to move to Tunbridge Wells, and they take into account the amount of money they would have to pay for a season ticket and the cheaper housing that they could buy, and they'd factor it all in. So you can make a decision as to whether it's better to have a more expensive property in London and not pay for a commuter thing. But I was in America not that long ago, and there's a train you can take from Connecticut into New York, which takes about 2 and a bit hours.
I've done that train; it's great.
Yeah, and it's Amtrak, and I think it's subsidised to an extent. It's only about $20, you know, and you're on a train for like 2.5 hours. I mean, here it would be literally 200.
Yeah,
it's the classic thing that we invent something and then just leave it at that.
Right.
Other nations get to do it as a second phase or third phase.
Right.
That's why other people's trains run better.
But equally,
you can also look at Japan, for example, about actual automatic trains. Like the fact that we don't have that in London is, and it's supposed to be one of the most international cities in the world.
Yeah. On the DLR, actually.
The DLR is one line out of how many?
I had a friend of mine who used to sit on the DLR and pretend to be driving it. And people would actually think he was the driver. You know, because
did he wear the outfit?
Yeah, you know, he used to wear a hat. And he was
like a crazy
in the front,
person.
And he would sit in the front, and the tourists would all think he was actually driving the train. Very funny. But you know, every other place you go, like France, they talk about the trains being great. It's all very heavily subsidised, but so is ours.
Yeah.
And I don't understand why ours
why is ours
so
the worst
crap.
Of everybody.
And what about, we haven't even mentioned HS2 yet.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean that. What
well, I mean, again, a lot, is that ever...
This is
I'm going to die before they
example.
Finish that.
HS2 is a perfect example of governments making risky decisions with our money, by the way.
Yeah.
This is taxpayer money being spent on it
yeah.
and entirely failing as a result. We've seen the different legs be cancelled. The
yeah.
leg between Birmingham and Manchester was cancelled,
yeah.
which basically renders HS2 useless.
Exactly.
And I actually think...
It's not so much of a Y shape now, it's just an I, isn't it?
But how can we look at examples like HS2 and then think, you know what the solution is? I want the government to take over all of it.
Yeah.
I mean, that's clearly not the right thing to do.
And the problem as well that people tell me with HS2 is that all the contractors are charging them the earth. You know, they just think of a number, double it, and then double it again, and just put it into the government, and somebody will sign it, and you'll get paid. You know,
we should have been developing infrastructure all along. This, the problem with HS2 is that it was sold as all about being about the speed.
Yeah.
It's not. It's about capacity. Get big, fast trains doing the big journeys on
yeah.
one track, and then you can have more of the smaller trains doing the shorter journeys. We will fail to have that. So we get none
right.
of either good worlds
yes.
there. But because we left it too late, instead of developing infrastructure all along,
right.
as the country grew, as we needed it, we just wait and go, no, let's make some
yeah.
massive plan.
I mean, I must admit, as I say, I don't often do it, but if I do travel on the train, if it does work, it is quite a good way to travel, you know, as long as it goes to the place you're going to, you know. But the trouble is it doesn't. Manchester City and Manchester United are going to play each other in the FA Cup final sometime in May, right? Now, they haven't yet decided when the kickoff is, but if the kickoff is a late kickoff at, say, 5 o'clock, which it might be, because the BBC have got some other sporting event at 3, the last train to Manchester is at 8 o'clock. So if it goes to penalties, nobody's going to get the train.
And
you're kind of going, it's a Saturday night. It's a foot, and nobody ever says, well, why don't we just put some extra trains on?
No, it's the same thing with, absolutely not quite the same thing, but the same thing with Brighton Pride.
Yeah.
They did that last year.
Yeah, I heard about that.
So many trains.
Nobody could get on.
And because they decided to have the strike that day.
Yeah.
When there's literally, sometimes Brighton Pride has up to 1 million people.
Yeah.
And it's almost impossible.
Same with Glasgow.
Why are you working with us, the people?
Right. Yeah.
But this is the problem with franchising the railways and the current system that we have. What incentive does Avanti West Coast have to add additional trains in the evening? What incentive do private companies have? Because they're not going to make any
money. Well,
there'll
be people on them for a start paying.
No, but this is the point. We have actually seen over the last few years an increase in capacity, an increase in the amount of passengers that use the train.
Yeah.
But what incentive does a private company have to actually increase or improve the service? They're not gaining anything from it. And this is the problem with governments handing out contracts. Governments are making the choices, not us. And the whole point of a market economy is that consumers make choices.
Yeah.
This is not an example of that.
But that's the trouble. Almost everything that's been privatised in this country has been badly privatised and has still left us with a massive bill.
It has to do with the privatisation process. So Thames Water, you mentioned water, is a really good example of that. What often
that's going really well, isn't it?
Is, well,
Thames Water, brilliant.
Well, what often
terrible.
Happens is, as these companies are public...
This has come straight from Thames Water.
It's lovely
and
clear.
That's fresh water from Thames Water,
fresh
that is.
Thames Water. So what happens is the regulations that are effectively moulded for Thames Water means that when they're privatised, they become a public monopoly. Private monopoly. So they become a public... They're a public monopoly, they become a private monopoly. So governments effectively are saying, you know what, you're going to have the majority of business in this market area. What we actually need is choice and competition. And often these regulations allow incumbents like Thames Water to stay as successful as
but
they
are.
But
let's listen to Mr. Dan Harvey, who was just on, and he seemed quite positive that it was the right way to go.
He knows his stuff, that guy, as well.
He does. And he
trains
would,
need
and
tracks.
But he said nothing to change.
And railway trains.
He said things are going to change. And I was into
see
that.
That.
So
I'm going to try this Thames Water.
No, don't.
If I don't die.
Oh, no, Mike.
Disgusting. Anyway, just a quick reminder that Talk, the home of common sense, of course, is going digital. Make sure you're ready, because from Monday, you can watch live on YouTube and listen to Talk on radio via DAB Plus or your smart speaker.
Very good morning to you.
Thanks for joining us.
The home of big opinions.
Oh, don't start me on that.
Straight talking.
There's a sort of feeling they ought to look as if they're doing something.
And no nonsense.
So don't accuse anyone else of stoking culture wars.
Is going digital.
Such as the smoke and mirrors of politics.
Make sure you're ready.
But the government has got to be more flexible.
From the end of April, listen to Talk on radio via DAB or your smart speaker. Or watch live on YouTube on your connected TV.
I don't know what that guy at the end is doing, but I'm doing breakfast, so you can see me from 6:30 on Monday. Thank you very much indeed. You're watching The Independent Republic of Mike Graham. Coming up, English children topping the global chart. But it's not the record we all wanted. Welcome back. You're watching the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk TV. Now, time for some sobering truths. A report commissioned by the World Health Organization shows Britain's world leading for child alcohol consumption. One in every three 11-year-olds in England have consumed alcohol. Meanwhile, children with middle-class parents are more likely to drink underage, while girls are more likely to drink and vape than their male counterparts. Joining me down the line from the Health Doctors Clinic is Dr. Wendy Denning. Dr. Wendy, very good evening to you. Thanks for joining us on the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. I mean, I've always known that that teenagers can quite easily manage to get their hands on a drink from time to time, but I didn't know it was quite as young as 11. I mean, that's quite a staggering fact, isn't it?
I think it's quite shocking, actually.
Yeah.
But I think the important thing is that we are a drinking culture. We do really need to acknowledge that. We need to look at it. Having worked in other countries, worked in Canada, people there don't drink nearly as much alcohol as we do here. People, my husband's Dutch, he can't believe that people just go out to get drunk.
Right.
In Holland, they do get drunk, but they don't go out with the purpose of getting drunk. So I think we can say this is shocking that children are doing this, but actually, what are we doing as adults? What are we showing our children? I mean, in the pandemic, alcohol consumption went up by 25%.
Right.
And it didn't go up in France. And why didn't it go up in France? Because in France, people go out to drink with their mates and their friends. Here, people just drink at home in a different way. So we do have to be looking at ourselves and wondering what contribution we as adults have done to create this.
But is it a question of the amount we drink or the frequency? What is it? Because, I mean, you know, we've all been to foreign countries. They drink. They have bars. They have restaurants. They have wine lists. You know, they have beer that they make. They have their own spirits that they make. You know, there's plenty of alcohol on sale, if you like. But what's the difference between the way they consume it and the way we do?
I mean, when I lived in Canada, you know, people would drink maybe 5 units a week. I came back to this country and I was, you know, regularly seeing patients that were drinking 21 units a week. And when I said something to them, they said, they didn't really see that there was anything wrong with it, even though government guidelines, which are actually higher than real health guidelines, are already at 14 units. So there's a culture here among people that is higher even than government guidelines. So we don't acknowledge the amount that we do drink, I think, is the truth of it.
Right. And what about these 11-year-old drinkers? I mean, the World Health Organization has done a study, presumably. How did they discover this particular piece of news, and where are those 11-year-olds getting the drink from?
Well, that's a good question. Why weren't they in school, by the way? But, you know, that's an interesting question, actually, because there's been a lot more since the pandemic. There's been a lot more kids out of school than there were before. So is this contributing to the problem? We've also got depression and anxiety shot through the roof. What do people do when they feel a bit depressed and anxious? They go and find themselves a drink, you know. So, and I think, I mean, it's no great surprise to me that it was the older it was surprised to me actually how young it went to, but it wasn't a surprise to me that people coming from more affluent backgrounds are drinking more because they've got more access to money, I think.
Right. Yeah, maybe. I mean, I know, for example, just from my own experience with having kids and my older sort of teenagers now, you know, any teenager of mine that's been under 18 finds it very difficult to get a drink in any pub anywhere near where we live, because they get asked for ID, and unless you've got fake ID, I suppose. But I can't imagine you get fake ID when you're 11, because you look 11.
No, somebody else is buying that drink for them. They've got a mate that's buying it for them. That's for sure.
Yeah, exactly right. But I mean, what are the parents doing? I mean, are we talking? But there's two things going on here, because one, on the one hand, they're saying many affluent parents' children are drinking more. But presumably that's not the 11-year-olds, because no sensible parent would let their child drink at 11, surely to God.
Agreed.
So presumably these are kids who might already be in all sorts of other difficulties.
That's how I read it. And that's why I brought up the whole thing about how many kids are not at school at this moment. It's the highest level of any time that we've got of kids not being at school.
Right.
And it's the highest level of, you know, serious mental health problems in this age group since the pandemic. I mean, there's a shocking statistic that suggests that this generation of kids that have gone through the pandemic are going to take about 10 years from a mental health point of view to recover from it as a society, not necessarily the individual, but as a society to regroup from where, come back to where we were.
Right.
I mean, that's shocking.
I mean,
I was going to talk about the vaping. I mean, I was shocked at the level of vaping, but vaping is, I think, almost as big a problem, if not more so.
Right. Well, because we don't really know. I mean, the one thing at least we know about the alcohol is that you know what it does. You know what long-term health effects it's going to have. But nobody really knows what long-term health effects vaping will have because it hasn't been around very long.
And we are already in the medical profession starting to see the impact on the lungs. So we already see that. Mm. So it's fairly shocking. And I was very disappointed to hear that, you know, they're bringing in a new bill to, you know, ban smoking. But what about banning the vaping? I mean, they're not actually going to ban them. We're going to make it more difficult and change the packaging and change, you know, reduce the flavors and make it less acceptable to children. Where's the banning, you know, for that age group? I mean, what is this?
But the trouble is, they are banned, aren't they? I mean, you're not supposed to be able to buy vapes if you're under 18. You're not supposed to be able to buy cigarettes if you're under 18. You're not supposed to be able to buy alcohol. You're not supposed to be able to buy marijuana. But they managed to do it somehow, so I'm not sure that banning it even works, to be honest.
Well, that's a fair point, but I think, you know, I think the other thing is that kids are exposed to a lot of advertising, and so they do see, you know, on video games and also, you know, just watching TV, TikTok, whatever, there are things where they get exposed to the advertising and it makes it something as cool to do. But I just feel that, you know, if it was banned in more places, and if there was, you know, an absolute ban on advertising of it on any platform where there are kids, you know, I agree it's difficult, but I think we've got a fairly lax attitude towards vaping, which I think we're going to pay in the long term a very high price for it.
Yeah. You may well be absolutely right about that. Dr. Wendy Denny, thank you very much indeed. Good to see you. We'll talk some more about that when the panel come back in a bit later on, of course, in the show. You're watching The Independent Republic of Mike Graham. Coming up next, the first deportation flight to Rwanda has been booked, according to Number 10. So how long will it be? We've got the million-dollar question. When's it going to take off? Welcome back. You're watching The Independent Republic of Mike Graham. The first deportation flight to Rwanda has been booked, according to Number 10, with the controversial bill now law after receiving royal assent. The first group of people to be deported have also been identified, with the Prime Minister promising earlier this week the first flight would take off in 10 to 12 weeks. It comes as a new report by the Refugee Council forecasts more than 115,000 asylum seekers will be left in permanent limbo, costing taxpayers £17 million a day. Unbelievable. Joining me now is Henry Bolton, former UKIP leader, and Andrew Ebord, broadcaster and barrister. There he is. Welcome to both of you. Thank you very much for joining us. Now, I mean, I never thought I'd actually read those words or say those words, that the law has now been passed.
Yes,
we now have a law that actually does mean that we can send people to Rwanda. One, I don't understand why it's going to take 10 to 12 weeks. Two, if they've booked a flight, who have they booked it with?
Yes.
And will that end up taking off? Three, these people who are going to be in limbo, hundreds of thousands of them probably by the end of the you know, the next couple of years, you know, what are we going to do with them?
Yeah. Well, Ryanair has offered to fly these people, apparently. So I understand. But
will they charge them for luggage?
Yes.
Yeah, 20 quid.
They'll be able to choose their seat for an extra 20 quid or something. Yeah. The refugee council are absolutely right, but it's not actually the Rwanda bill that is causing this problem.
Right.
What it is, it's the Immigration Act, Illegal Migration Act from last year.
Right.
Because that actually said, and I think a lot of people would agree with this, and it didn't get that much coverage, that if you enter this country bypassing immigration controls. And if you have come not, or you have not come directly from the country from which you are seeking protection, so you've come through a safe, for example, European Union country, and you don't have the leave to remain here, then you either get sent back to, or your claim, your asylum claim, is not valid.
Right.
So you, if you meet those conditions, your asylum claim, you're not entitled to make an asylum claim under the Immigration Act. Now, what that does is it, when we've still got all the boats coming, because we've not stopped the boats, it means that we've got people coming into this country who, ever since that act passed in July last year, their claim for asylum, or 91% of them, is not valid.
Right.
So it won't be accepted.
Right.
So they don't, they're just here in limbo.
But they can't be deported.
Well, they can be deported back to their own country.
Yeah.
But if that's, if on a sort of dangerous list, for example, Afghanistan, we can't send them there. So that is why Rwanda. That's why we've got the Rwanda bill.
Right.
Now, the Rwanda, none of this actually deters the boats.
Right.
Because we're still not doing anything about the boats.
But also, we can't send that many people to Rwanda because they can take a few hundred.
Exactly. Now, that is why I suspect we've heard rumours that the government has been in talks with the Ivory Coast, Botswana,
Costa Rica,
Armenia.
But it's ridiculous, isn't it?
It's bonkers. They're addressing, as I've always said, Mike, they are address. We've got to deal with the people who are already here.
Yeah.
That's, of course, a case. And this maybe has part of a role to play in that. But what the focus should be on is stopping more and more people coming here.
Yeah.
And that is the piece that I just don't see being put on the board.
No. But surely, Andrew, if they start getting rid of some of these people who are in limbo and sending them somewhere, that might be a deterrent.
Well, it depends. And the real key, and Henry and I were discussing this earlier, is that the real question is, do the people know this is what's going to happen to them? Because the whole idea is, we always say, it's the abhorrent people trafficking that we've got to target.
Yeah.
But we've got to get the message to people, say, look, if you try to come here, it's not all paved with gold. You're going to be sent away. This is the process that's going to happen. And we've had, what, 6,667 people crossing so far this year.
Yeah, but that's a bit of a drop in the ocean.
It's nothing compared
to the numbers who are here in limbo.
But totally limbo.
But
this doesn't deal with that.
Coming, even if you send some to Rwanda, there are still more coming. And one of the things, Andrew says, we were talking about this earlier, and one of the things here is most members of the British public don't have a clue what's going on.
Right.
How can we expect the migrants or the asylum seekers or the economic migrants, whatever you want to call them, how come they... it's only a deterrent if they know that there's going to be a problem in their, in their journey.
Well, presumably most of them know, for example, because they see it either on TikTok or they get messages from people who have got here. They come to Britain, you'll be fine, you'll be looked after.
Well, that's the message that they're still getting.
Right.
They're not getting the message that you are not going to be allowed to stay here.
Right.
Yeah. And even if they do, then they're getting the message, well, actually, the government's saying that, but they're only going to be able to send this tiny proportion to Rwanda, so you're going to stay in the UK.
And it's the point, it's the point we made beforehand. I mentioned this movement called Io Capitano, which gives you a different view, because it's actually the people who've been told along the way, this is paved with gold, this is the route you have to do. And they talk about the torture and the murders and that sort of stuff. What we need to do is get that message through the ranks and that this is going to happen, and it's not paved with gold. This is what's going to happen to
you. But the bottom line as well, and I meant to ask you this when you were on last time, Henry, the problem is no longer just a pan-European one.
Yeah.
It's a global one.
Oh, absolutely.
You've now got people being moved from sub-Saharan Africa over to South America and Central America to go into the US via Tijuana, right? Yeah. So that's all going on as well.
So
clearly, people are moving around the world because they think, rightly or wrongly, that wherever they end up will be better than where they were.
Yeah, absolutely. And because organised crime is not being dealt with. Organised crime is marketing this. You know, they're putting out the equivalent of their glossy brochures saying, you know, Costa del Tell London or whatever, and making it all look very attractive. And once these people are in the grips of organised people smugglers, then it's very difficult for them to escape. Some of the cases that I dealt with some years ago when I was combating this problem in southern Europe was that they would have their passports taken off them. We had them throwing their passports away. But their passports, any documentation would be taken off them by the people smugglers because they don't want this person to suddenly change their mind and say, actually, I want to go back.
Right.
And a lot of those passports are forged along the way anyway, so different people.
So,
but what was interesting as well, though, were the stats on this sort of stuff, because they say, actually, the vast majority are Vietnamese, followed by Afghans, followed by Iranians, Syrians, and Iraqis,
but
in that
but
order.
But isn't that also slightly misleading because I looked at these figures a couple of years ago. And unfortunately, what you'll probably find is that the largest number are of no fixed country.
Yes, you're
because
right.
People don't say where they're actually from.
So what
you're actually telling me is that the ones who are from Vietnam are the probably biggest group of people who identify where they're from.
I think you're right.
Which is not the same.
And we have a problem with our immigration sort of the processing of it in that we don't have people sufficiently well trained to know whether somebody is saying, you know, I'm an Iraqi Kurd, or are they from Turkey?
Right.
It's very difficult unless you have...
As they did with the Albanians.
Absolutely. Yes. That was a classic case of that. The Albanian population lives across four countries. They all speak the same language. They all identify as Albanian. But actually, where do you return them to?
Yeah.
Which country did they actually come from?
And also those who came seeking asylum because of what was going on in Kosovo.
Yeah. Yes.
Suddenly, you know, everybody from Albanian sort of heritage came and pretended that they were Muslims under attack and under threat.
Yes.
And that's part of the problem.
But this is what I've said all along, Mike, is that there is no silver bullet. People say, how do you stop the boats?
Yeah.
But all of this that we're discussing now is a very complex suite of challenges that we have to overcome.
Yeah.
It requires a government approach that is integrated, comprehensive, and focused on what is it we're trying to achieve here.
Yeah.
So it pulls it all together. You know, the fact of the matter is, and in the conversations I've had behind closed doors, Rishi Sunak has not wanted the Rwanda bill to be any tighter. Mm. Rishi Sunak has allowed the Foreign Office to hold the Home Office back.
Yeah.
And we already know that the Home Office is in a mess in this regard.
Yeah.
So there are huge challenges here. And without really strong leadership in number 10 Downing Street, leading the cabinet, pulling them together on this issue, I think we are going to be talking about this for many years to come.
Oh, I'm sure.
Yeah.
One of the things that's going to happen next week, believe it or not, is the civil service union in the Home Office is taking the government to court over the Rwanda bill.
You're
kind of going, well, that's the first problem, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's the first sort of, you know, hurdle
crazy,
to get over, which they probably won't get over. And then we know that anybody they do try and send, whether it's in 10 weeks or 12 weeks or 20 weeks, they will be stopped by lawyers.
It's crazy.
Like, all the time that we're talking about this and all the time the government is failing to be decisive on this is time during which this country is having increasing pressure placed on its housing, its public utilities, its economy, its society.
Hospitals, doctors.
And indeed, our entire identity and culture, I would suggest.
And you're not going to get the public behind. When you see the stats, £17 million pounds a day when we have a cost of living crisis, it's only going to backfire on that. But you say about being decisive. I think they're still missing the point, which we all agree on. It's about communication to the people traffickers and those who want to make the journey, the perilous journey sometimes, that this is what's going to happen to you and therefore you've got to stop
the message of risk to the organised criminals, it's a message of deterrence or sort of kill the motivation of the migrants, and it's a message to the British people that we are actually doing something real and solid about
it. And you could warn them.
None of that messaging is coming.
And you could warn them there may be a Labour government when they arrive.
Well, that's another problem, isn't it? You know, because they're not going to have any money. They're spending it all on privatising or taking back the trains.
Well, the Labour government is going to... Oh,
never mind. It's going to be a nightmare. You're watching the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. Coming up, Rachel Reeves, speaking of Labour, has claimed that Labour can be pro-business, much more so than the Tories, even more than Tony Blair. But will her claims actually stack up? We'll talk about that coming next. Welcome back to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk TV. Now it's time for Taking the Mic. Well, I think we can firmly say that we have now heard it all. One of the most inoffensive comedy shows of all time has been hit with a series of trigger warnings because the woke warriors at ITV think it might upset a few viewers. Terry and June, an innocuous primetime family show which ran in the 70s and 80s with that terrible music, has been slapped with advisory guidance for people who haven't seen it before due to what ITV calls discriminatory language of the period. I'll try that again. Discriminatory language of the period. Terry Scott and June Whitfield play a middle-aged, middle-class, married suburban couple who live in Purley in Surrey. He works for PlaySafe Fire Extinguishers and she spends most of the show putting up with his childlike tantrums, big ideas which always fail, and schemes that always end in disaster. He's a hapless individual and he's basically harmless, as is the show. But of course, we can't have old-fashioned language when the reruns are shown on BritBox, which is a joint venture between BBC Studios and ITV. Fans of the retro television golden age have hit out on social media calling the warnings laughable. One said, It must be the episode where the vicar's trousers fell down when he called round to collect things for the church fete. Cue a sharp intake of breath from the new audience. In one episode, Terry responded to someone singing with the immortal line, "Last time I heard screeching like that was when I accidentally vacuumed the cat." Apparently, ITV were worried this would offend animal lovers. In another scene, Terry's boss is in a Native American fancy dress costume, and of course, we can't be having any of that cultural appropriation, can we? And in yet another howler, Terry has some controversial views about Zimbabwe. Worse still, there's an episode where Terry's at a work conference and he accidentally puts on his wife's perfume by mistake. Apparently, his boss hates gay people and Terry's terrified about being thought of as gay. Truly shocking stuff. ITV say this: "We regularly re-examine historical programming in order to review, relabel, provide context and ensure the right guidance is in place." Heaven help us. Surely the point of watching this old stuff, which used to regularly pull in an audience of 15 million people a show, by the way, is to see it in all its glory and wonder at why things like that were even funny back in the day. It's a serious case of oversensitive ninnies in a TV being frightened of their own shadows. Terry Scott had a nervous breakdown around about the time the show was axed in 1988. It was said to have been brought on by the real-life revelation that he had a string of mistresses during his marriage to former dancer Maggie Pollan. And at the time, he said, "I know it would be better to give up the booze, fags and birds, but life would be so boring, wouldn't it?" Cue studio canned laughter and another trigger warning. Well, I don't know if any of you remember Terry and June. Andrew Ebel was here. Terry and June, can you believe they've got a trigger warning on it?
I know, that's incredible. It was glorious.
I know. Well, I mean, you know, whenever you look back at some of those old shows, I mean, even Fawlty Towers, remember they had to remove it from
the German episode.
From the BBC They removed the German episode. They finally put it back on, but with a warning.
Yes.
But the whole point, surely, of watching some of this old stuff is that you sort of slightly chuckle at how ludicrous the comedy was. Because some of the comedy was very funny, but a lot of it wasn't very funny at all.
Yeah, I mean, the secret of comedy is knowing where the line is and going beyond it.
Yeah.
And that's the whole idea. You have to cause offence. But Terry and June were glorious. June Whitfield, I used to go out with a girl who was a hairdresser once when I was about...
Did you?
When I was about in my teens.
Right.
Yeah, so glorious. I mean, she was lovely in real life.
Yeah.
And Terry was a laugh every minute.
Right. Well, indeed he was, and he was quite a busy boy by the
sounds of it
as well. But anyway, if I become Chancellor, so the saying goes, the next Labour government is going to be the most pro-business government this country has ever seen. Those are not my words, by the way. That is Shadow Chancellor Rachel Reeves, who is also planning to raise £22 billion of private sector investment in green energy projects, as well as £7.3 billion worth of taxpayers' cash. Now, I'm not quite sure exactly where this money is going to come from. Andrew, we talked about the money that they're going to spend on trains earlier on. And clearly, the Labour Party have forgotten all about how difficult it is to raise money for all of the various projects that they want to do. And as we were just saying, they're going to have to find, what, $17 billion a day to pay for the migrants?
Absolutely crazy. And it's a glorious phrase, but there is no money, magic money to
it.
I think what we have to do in any of these conversations, say, look, of course you want all these services, but they're going to cost this where the money's coming from. Just promising something is just reckless.
Yeah.
And so you need to look at that sort of basis.
Well, exactly right. And Rachel Reeves has already been sort of pulled up in a couple of instances because she's put out all sorts of messages in the last couple of weeks, one of which I think was that we're going to rebuild so many houses and we're going to build so many houses that we will be the party of house builders.
Yes, the Bob the Builders will be.
And we're going to build thousands and thousands and thousands of houses for people. And you know that that's going to come back to haunt her.
Yeah,
because one of the things that all governments don't do is build houses.
Yeah, well,
it's
unless,
so
unless it's for the Deputy Prime Minister on the other side.
Well, that's different.
That might happen on that sort of basis.
Well, Angela Rayner defended herself, didn't she, this week in Prime Minister's like questions. Funny. And said that the Tories are obsessed with her. Well, of course they are, because it's the only thing they can nail on the Labour Party.
Yeah, glorious.
But at the moment, they have got this ridiculous kind of smorgasbord of here's where we're going to spend a load of money. And I thought they'd said only, what, a month ago, that they're not going to say or promise anything that cannot be properly costed.
Well,
they've already thrown it out the window.
No, you're absolutely right, Mike. And people need to hold their feet to the fire on this one. And the British public are not stupid.
Right.
So all of these idle promises which are not properly costed are meaningless. And people should. They should question everything.
Well, they should. But, I mean, the problem for, as well as it was for the Tories when they came in, as you say, when Liam Byrne left a note saying there wasn't any money, is there won't be any money either.
Right.
But let's talk to former Labour Minister Dennis McShane. He joins me now because there's an awful lot of promises promises being made. Dennis, welcome to the Independent Republic, by the way. Nice to see you. There's an awful lot of promises being made, but I'm not quite sure how much money they're going to have.
Really? I'm checking. I can't find hardly any promises. You go out on the, with the Labour Party, and a lot of guys there are saying, well, where are the promises? Where is the beef? This is the most cautious, conservative offer from a Labour Party in my lifetime, when I first stood for Parliament in 1974. And I think what Rachel Rees is saying, it's what you'd hear in Germany, in Sweden, in Canada, in Australia. It is the private sector that has to be involved. What she could do, what the government could do, is make things a lot easier. You mentioned housing. You said, well, how can that be done? How can they promise that? Harold Macmillan, Tory housing minister, 1951, built 300,000 houses a year, and it kept the Tories in power until 1964. He didn't run around saying, oh, where's the money going to come from? There is money out there. There's builders out there. What you have to do is sweep away a lot of the bureaucracy, planning bureaucracy, the NIMBYs, the people who don't want any. They're very happy they've got their house, but they damn well don't want their grandchildren or anybody else to have one. That is a political fight, and I think Rachel Reeves is probably up for it.
She may well be, but I'm still asking you where the money's coming from, because here's one of her own tweets, right, from the last day. If I become Chancellor, I will work hand-in-hand with business to grow our economy. You know, so far, so nebulous. It is only by unlocking business investment that we can lift living standards and achieve our potential. I mean, it's all very simple, isn't it? It all sounds all right, but what does it mean?
It's a task for her and for business. Do business want to re-elect Liz Truss? Do business want to have a Tory government well before Liz Truss or Boris Johnson that just gave in to local NIMBYs and stopped nearly all successful development? Does business want to work with universities? Because you know, there's plenty of money there in the cities, in savings accounts. I've got young children. They'd be quite happy to trade up a house. They're saving hard. My son is. And it's there if the offer comes in, and that can't happen if we operate as the way we've operated in the last 40 years. I tend to say last 20 years. It's just been a culture of not supporting business. Culture simply of the only way you should make money is speculating. The city boys, the Silicon Valley boys, the hedge fund boys, they're all friends of mine. I like them loads, but we need business in Halifax. We need business in Rotherham. We need to unleash that. I agree.
What we need to do, Dennis, is to make things again, don't we? We need to go back to manufacturing as opposed to having this ridiculous economy which is entirely furnished economically by the finance services industry. And that's all we really do. You know, we've already heard from Vauxhall today who are saying, you know, if you don't stop this ridiculous net zero nonsense, we're probably going to pull Vauxhall out of Britain because we don't want to make electric cars. We're going to be killed by the Chinese. You know, we're not making anything anymore.
I agree. I mean, our industry's down to 8%. That's Margaret Thatcher's heritage. I mean, that is.
Oh, that's too far away. Listen, I'm very happy to blame this government and the one before and the one before, but I'm not going to take you blaming Thatcher still after all this time. There are people listening to this who weren't even alive when she died.
Well, I'm sorry, I was alive and I saw what it did to the north. She did to the north of England. She unleashed the city. She did things like selling off council houses, but without letting the councils build a single
new one. Yeah, Angela Rayner bought one of them.
And there's no social housing program in the world that works without a renewal of social housing, and she killed that.
Well, now we're giving half the social housing that we've got, though, to people who are coming into the country illegally, which is not helping either. But we've got to run. I'm going to get you back, Dennis. I've got to get you back on because we haven't got time. Thank you very much indeed. We could have a very good row about this, I'm sure. Andrew, thank you very much. Andrew Evil will be back later as well. You're watching The Independent Republic of Mike Graham. She's at it again at why BBC newsreader is truly the gift that keeps on giving as she once again amuses her viewers with an interesting on-air choice of behaviour.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Good evening and welcome back to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. You're with Talk, we're on TV, we're on radio, we're online, and of course we're on your smart speaker. Coming up, the Royal Jam War gains pace as Buckingham Palace releases images of its own custom-made condiments. Plus, is shoplifting now effectively decriminalised? Offences rise to the highest level since records began. The nudists on the south coast have become embroiled in a planning row over fears a new upmarket development could force them off their favourite beach. Heaven help us. Sorry about that. I think you're traumatised. It's fair to say that the BBC have not been having a good time of late. Their highest-paid TV news presenter resigned earlier this week after allegations he exchanged inappropriate messages with a young person and then gave them money. Now, this seems fair enough. However, the presenter continues to be paid his six-figure salary 8 months after his last television appearance. And with all the attention on BBC News, you'd think Hugh's former colleagues would remain professional. But that's not the case for one presenter. Now, I'm sure you remember that earlier this week, a British boy won a seagull impression contest, and rightfully so. Here it was.
3, 2, 1.
Now, you can't beat that, can you? You'd have to be a total clown to try to upstage him. Or you could be BBC News presenter Marion Mashiri. Well, unsatisfied with the boy, or in fact any news she's supposedly reporting, taking the spotlight, she seems to be using her high-profile job to audition to become a comedian. So we thought we'd help you out, Mariam, and cut you a comedy showreel, starting with your licence fee-funded seagull impression. Let's go.
I can feel that you really want me to do an impression of a seagull, so I'm going to give it a go. Is that OK? I'm hearing in my ear that I've been sacked. Oh, well, it only occurs when the moon is at its closest point in the orbit around the Earth. I'm so sorry, and I have a picture to show you. It looked a little bit like this. There you go. Super moon. Thank
you. If that's how you behave presenting the news, I think the BBC had better put you on secondment to CBeebies. Now, later on the show, we'll be bringing you a first look at tomorrow's front pages. But before anyone else, we've got an exclusive look at the Metro newspaper, and we can bring you that. And that is, of course, about the Harvey Weinstein story. Incredible story, which broke a little bit earlier on today. Weinstein sensation, it says. Now the accusers face retrial ordeal, but jailed movie mogul will stay locked up. Basically, his rape conviction was overturned by a New York appeal court. They say he didn't get a fair trial at the time. They said prosecutors were wrongly allowed to call witnesses whose claims were not actually included in the charges. And they also said that the 2020 trial judge allowed him to be questioned in a highly prejudicial way before his conviction and 23-year sentence for rape and sexual assault. You remember, of course, that Harvey Weinstein was accused by a whole panoply of different women for behaving in a way which was not only horrible but also criminal. But of course, he won't be released from prison because he is still convicted for a different rape case, which is what he's actually serving time for. So this trial may have to take place again, and the Me Too crowd are not very happy about it. However, it will not really change anything for Harvey Weinstein. But we'll talk a bit more, of course, about that right now, because Hollywood mogul Harvey Weinstein's rape conviction, as we said, has been overturned by New York's top court. Weinstein was at the centre of a media firestorm after numerous women accused him of sexual abuse, kicking off that Me Too era. And the New York Court of Appeals found that prosecutors were allowed to call witnesses whose accusations were not part of the original trial. He will remain in prison, though, for a separate conviction, as I said, for rape. Joining me now is Kinsey Schofield, the host of the To Die For daily podcast. Kinsey, this was a remarkable story at the time. I remember when it broke first and, you know, one woman after another came forward, some of them very famous, some of them who had worked with him for years and years and years, to tell terrible stories of how he had behaved around them. Rape allegations, sexual assault allegations, lots of very, very murky dealings that would take place whenever they were working on a movie with him. But this kind of came out of the blue, I must admit. When I heard this story breaking this afternoon, I wasn't aware that he had made an appeal. Tell us about it.
I mean, that's right. If you think about it, it was Rose McGowan, Ashley Judd, some of these women that said they had experienced horrible interactions with Harvey Weinstein. And when they refused his advances or threatened to go public with their issues with him, he said, "I'm going to sabotage your career." And if you look at the trajectory of their careers, you see that he literally did everything in his power to do exactly that. So he is going to stay in jail. He's going to be moved from New York to Los Angeles, where he is going to have to he's going to have to deal with, I believe it was 16 years he got for the sexual assault convictions in LA. They could potentially take this to trial again in New York. However, you see how busy they are trying to take Donald Trump down. They're busy in New York right yes. now dealing with all of their Trump trauma. So will they do this immediately? Highly likely not. Will they ever do it? I think that there are going to be several victims that fight that does happen. But as you said, that judge just, or the highest court in New York just saying, you know what? There were too many people on the witness stand that weren't directly involved in what he's being accused of right here. So I think that the likelihood of him getting a conviction again is high, but does New York's district attorney have the time to take that on today? The right. answer is probably not.
No, exactly right. Because the original kind of charges and the allegations still stand. It's not as though they've kind of disappeared, right? It's just the fact that the case was wrongly prosecuted, if you like, because there were too many other cases which, you know, in most criminal situations, you can't take other cases into account, and they shouldn't have done it.
Yeah, I think that this was an error on the prosecution's part. They got a little big for their britches and thought, we're going to put a parade in a parade of victims in front of this jury to ensure that we get the conviction that we want. And honestly, the judge should have sat back and said where was the judge to determine that some of these witnesses were inappropriate? So a lot of mistakes were made in the first trial, and hopefully those victims get a second trial so that they feel like they are heard.
Yes, exactly right. And I mean, if you think back, I suppose, to those days of the Me Too movement, if you like, if that's what we're going to call it, I mean, it was a very high pressure atmosphere, wasn't it, for an awful lot of people who had worked in that business and who had worked with Weinstein, because it was very clear, like we've seen in cases here, that a lot of people knew what he was doing.
Oh, it was the Hollywood secret. You know, everybody, to the point where it was a joke. It was like, don't go up to Harvey Weinstein's hotel room. Or if you were going to a casting audition, it was like, I hope it's not at a hotel room. I mean, it was such a joke. I mean, and how gross that it was a joke. When ultimately, when we started to hear people that were brave enough to tell their story, you realize how terribly horrific some of these exchanges were. And I mean, just such an abuse of power. And you realize that how how forgiving this town can be if you can make them a little money. I mean, it's kind of disgusting if you think about it.
Exactly. And is there any sort of evidence, I'm sure there might be, that the business has now changed, that there are no more kind of Harvey Weinstein-type figures? I mean, we talked the other day about Rebel Wilson's accusations of what went on some of the movie sets that she's been on. Funnily enough, interestingly enough, Sacha Baron Cohen has come out here and said what the reality of the situation is. He's basically saying that some of the allegations she made about him are in fact inaccurate and completely false. And he's also had her book, which is published here this week, redacted and had all of those passages about him taken out for legal reasons. So he's refusing to say that that's true. But are other actors and actresses now saying that Hollywood has kind of cleaned up its act?
Absolutely not. And let me tell you why. We had COVID, and then we had the actors and the writers strike. So people are desperate to get back to work. They're desperate to book that job. They need that gig. And so they are putting up with a lot of things that normally they wouldn't, or that they thought the Me Too movement or the Time's Up movement had cleaned up. They're having to suck it up and just deal with it because they need the work. I mean, that's between, if you think about COVID and then the writers and actors strike, that's a significant amount of time that people were out of work. And then you've got these streaming platforms that have to pump out content or they lose subscribers. And so they want to get it. They want to get people in and out. They want to get projects, you know, greenlit and shot and out there for the masses. And they're really not worried about people's well-being in the process. And I mean, that's the unfortunate truth. And you look at the Quiet on Set documentary that came out last month here in the States. There was a pedophile convicted of molesting a child on the Nickelodeon set. As soon as he was released from jail, the Disney Channel hired him to work with children on the Disney Channel set. So, I mean, no. The short answer is no.
That is incredible, isn't it, that that can still happen despite all of the things that have gone before. But let's take a little sidestep away from Hollywood and go back into what we now know to be Hollywood, I suppose, as well, and into Meghan world, because I see that basically Kris Jenner posted a snap of Meghan's jam on Instagram last night.
I think you meant from Hollywood to Holly Weird, right?
Holly
Did
Weird.
You ever in your life?
Yeah. Yes.
Did you
absolutely.
Ever in your life think we'd be talking about Kris Jenner talking about Meghan Markle's jam?
Right.
I mean, I have said for over a year now, Mike. I have said. Just watch this space. Meghan Markle will collaborate with the Kardashians. The Kardashians famous for a sex tape because Meghan Markle is desperate for, you know, any sort of relevance whatsoever. And here we are with Kris Jenner and Chrissy Teigen. Chrissy Teigen, who is also a good friend of the Kardashians, but absolutely notorious in the States for telling a 16-year-old girl to go kill herself. You know, bullies unite, I guess. But Meghan Markle distributing more of her jam to some celebrities. Again, we've talked about this influencer push, which is so bizarre to me when not a single soul can go on her website right now and purchase it. So what's the ultimate objective except attention? Attention seeking from the Montecito duo. I'm shocked.
I know. Absolutely incredible. Also, she's picked the wrong side in the Taylor Swift feud scenario, isn't she? Because if she's siding herself with the Kardashians, doesn't that mean that, you know, the Taylor Swifties will come for her because she's on the, you know, this is one of the enemy.
Spoken like a absolute genius, Mike. There's no way in hell I would go against the Swifties. Taylor has reopened that wound with her new song. I think it's called Thank You, Amy. I'm blasting it. It's amazing. And you're right. Remember, we've talked about this before, Meghan handwriting a note to Taylor trying to get her on her podcast.
Right.
And Meghan writing Taylor and Taylor's representatives then declining Meghan. Taylor didn't even respond to Meghan directly.
Oh dear. So, I mean, that could all go sort of terribly wrong for her as well, couldn't it? Let's talk about one of the tragic stories that was on the newspaper front pages this morning about a terrible story about Princess Beatrice's former boyfriend, Paolo Liuzzo, found dead from a suspected overdose in a hotel in Miami.
That's right. Sources told The Sun that he had struggled with drugs and honestly was haunted by gambling debts, constantly asking people to bail him out, constantly asking people if he could borrow money. He allegedly had repeated run-ins with the law, including over the death of a student and cocaine possession. it was kind of a scandal when he dated Princess Beatrice. He was on law enforcement's radar already. He was 23. She was 17. Mm. He was not the type of publicity that Buckingham Palace wanted, but it was also very York, you know, that it was the drama that kind of circles the York family. Right. Later in his life, though, he almost dismissed that relationship with Princess Beatrice, saying, I wasn't sure I wanted to get in that deep with B. I loved her, but I wasn't in love with her.
Right. But a very young age, isn't it, to die from such a terrible, terrible thing, really.
Yeah, I agree with you. But, you know, Miami's a dangerous city if you have those kind of vices. He was a Miami resident. He'd been working in the art industry as a consultant. I think that the art industry kind of has that reputation as well. He was never married. And ironically, his home was just a few blocks away from the hotel that he was found dead in. Right. So, you know, perhaps up to trouble in this hotel in Miami.
Yeah, I'm sure that's the case. I mean, this is the trouble. I mean, we talk about, you know, all sorts of things on this show. We talk about the immigration problems. We talk about the drug problems that we have in this country, the crime problems. I mean, you know, many of them don't so much go together that, you know, the people who are smuggling drugs into the country are often smuggling guns into the country as well. And it really is a massive problem, not only here, but also in the US as well. Still new drugs coming in from places like Mexico.
I mean, fentanyl is one of our biggest issues. I actually haven't seen Joe Biden mention it recently, but he should on the campaign trail, because you're seeing so many people bring fentanyl in through the state of Arizona. I mean, through the state of Arizona, yeah. Since you and I've been talking right now, probably 5,000 people have crossed the border. It's a terrible issue here in the States, not only drugs, but, you know, smuggling weapons. And hopefully it's something that we see addressed in this presidential campaign. But unfortunately, the Republican candidate is unable to campaign while he's on trial, which is convenient.
Although, of course, as I've been saying about his campaign abilities, campaigning doesn't need to happen while he's in the court, because he's doing all the campaigning he needs to do simply by being held there, because all of the people that want to vote for Donald Trump see him as the victim in that scenario. And so as soon as they see him coming out of court every day, that's another tick in the box.
Well, and he's been very strategic in the way that he does little stops here and there. Like he'll stop at a construction site prior to going into court, and he doesn't have to say a lot. And there are people that follow him around constantly, so they jump out of the car and grab their microphone or their cell phone and catch him talking to regular people, people that, you know, voting people, people that, you know, just normal people, not the elite, right? I mean, even the sight of Donald Trump ordering $500 worth of McDonald's for his staff going into the courtroom. He just has a very brilliant way of engaging with normal people, whether we recognize it or not. Yeah. I think that people see those kinds of headlines and they go, oh, I love McDonald's. Or, you know, oh, that's so nice that he stopped to talk to that regular person.
Yeah, no, I think he's definitely got the magic touch when it comes to dealing with the public, which most politicians don't have. Well, Kinsey, great to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed. As ever, Kinsey Schofield, the host of the To Die For podcast, with a whole variety of stories coming into us from the United States of America. But back home now, the latest ONS figures paint a bleak picture of Britain blighted by crime, which comes, of course, as no surprise to us at all. And there is no part of this nation that remains untouched by what we could call wrong-uns. As always, Sadiq Khan's London takes centre stage. Knife and gun offences have leapt by 20%. Last year, ONS statistics show more than 14,000 knife offences were recorded by police in London in 2023. There's also been a spike in violent robberies, teen homicides and incidents involving firearms. So, is there any coming back from this? We shall see. Let's now speak to former Metropolitan Police Detective Chief Inspector Mike Neville. Mike, good to talk to you. Nice to see you. Thanks very much indeed.
Nice to see you, Mike.
I see one of the figures that we didn't put into that little mix there was the shoplifting figures, which have also risen to an all-time high. I mean, I was talking only yesterday about shoplifting, because Sadiq Khan was asked, what would you do if you saw somebody shoplifting some nappies or some baby food? And he said, oh, I'd probably take my wallet out and pay for them. And you just go, mate, you're in charge of the Metropolitan Police. Surely to God, you should at least give the impression of wanting law and order to be upheld.
I mean, yesterday, Mike, I was outside Charing Cross Police Station, at Charing Cross Railway Station, and somebody tried to rob my phone. They rode by on a bike,
Yeah.
They tried to grab my phone. They failed to get my phone, but they grabbed a guy next to me. And it just seems like we're living in a lawless situation.
Yeah.
As you say, the shoplifting now has come to a point where every single person feels entitled to steal. You know, there's so much people, you can't buy coffee in a normal shop. You've got to ask for it behind the counter because, you know, those things, those items that are so easy to sell on. Mm. And where do we go from there? How do we reduce it? I mean, the biggest thing for my, in my view, is the biggest failing with the police is the use of CCTV. Nearly every one of the crimes you've mentioned, so shoplifting, robberies, when people have robbed somebody and escaped, there's a video of them nearby in the street. The police have a complete failure to deal with CCTV evidence properly. Yeah. That's the way they could crack down on this crime, but they seem seemingly unwilling to do so.
Yeah. Is that an issue of manpower, if you like? Is it because they haven't got anybody to trawl through it? I mean, remember the Azidi case where the guy was wanted for several days. Then it appeared that he was on CCTV walking up and down the river in London. He was captured on quite a lot of it, but it wasn't really found until after he'd walked past and eventually thrown himself in the river.
Well, what they've got, you see, what you have is you have a national fingerprint database and a national DNA database, but they haven't got the systems to deal with images. So if you leave your fingerprints in Bolton, Bournemouth and Belfast, you will be identified, the same with DNA.
Yeah.
But the CCTV systems, they aren't set up like that. So some of these people who are shoplifting, they don't commit one offence. They commit 10 a day.
Right.
And those 10 cases, if they're put together, these guys will go to jail. But the police don't have any systems to do that. They're not very good at digital evidence. And I get the impression that a lot of senior police officers are not too bothered about crime at the moment. It just doesn't seem to interest them.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because, I mean, I know for a fact, as I'm sure you do, that there are various kind of alerts that you can get hold of, and I have several of them from news sources that I have, where you find that there's a gang roaming up and down Park Lane, for example, stealing people's watches. Now, that's in real time that I'm getting that information. The police must know that there's a group of four young men, youths, walking around or sometimes on bicycles, basically hitting people up and taking their watches. And that's going on even as they speak. So those kids are robbing people. The police must know about it. And if they watch CCTV, if they don't want to do anything else, surely they must be able to capture them.
Well, there would be. And as a victim of crime, I'm not being funny, if my phone had gone yesterday, I'd willingly watch the CCTV myself to say to the police, I'll help you, I'll do this. And if you look at victims of burglary, in the last 10 years, the detection rate has gone from 15% to 5%. So really woeful at 15%, treble woeful at 5%. But during that last 10 years, 40% of households have invested in CCTV or some Ring doorbell. So people have all this footage. They have all the evidence to give to the police, but the police have not the systems to deal with it, and they don't seem to have the will to crack crime. It just seems to be that they've turned into some sort of a reporting agency because people only report crime if there's a benefit. So last night, I sort of said, oh, this guy next to me has been robbed, but why would I report it myself? My phone hasn't gone missing. People report it if their car's been stolen or the house has been burgled, and there's a benefit in the sense you need a reference number because of insurance.
Right.
But you don't. The sad thing is all people want is a crime number. They've simply given up on the fact that the police might catch the thief, the burglar or the rapist.
Right. And also, the police are always now in the frame for the wrong reasons. You know, we saw the Nottingham police still getting into trouble over their WhatsApp messages just this week. We've seen the Metropolitan Police under Sir Mark Rowley once again being shown up to have the completely wrong attitude about policing marches, particularly the pro-Palestine marches, you know, telling Jewish people that they shouldn't walk across the road. I mean, it just seems like they get it wrong all the time. And they've almost, it's almost as though they've become a sort of police force just for protest movements.
Well, that's right. I mean, where do we go, you know, with the lack of confidence in policing? So we've gone from a police force, which we've been told was so politically correct, that it's gone out of its way to be woke, and we've got a situation where Jewish people don't feel safe to walk around in London.
Right.
That's the really bizarre situation that we have. How can that be that we've gone to a situation where never before is a situation where one kind of minority thought they weren't safe to walk around in London. So for 20 years, the police have been converted into this absolute politically correct organisation. But it's like everything today. everything is a facade. It's everything what they say and not what they do. It's all words and not action.
Yeah, and people do want to see action. Have you got any hope for the Labour Party if they get in at the next election?
None whatsoever. I just think none whatsoever, because we've got sort of two political parties, and their sort of strat lines to be seems to be vote for me because I'm not as bad as the other lot.
Yeah. Yeah,
and that's really awful, isn't it? What kind of choice is that the public are being offered? It's really sad that we've got this situation in democracy. But from a policing point of view, we could do so much more. And we need to have a situation where people feel safe on the streets, whether they're white or black, Gentile or Jew, or any, or whatever you are, gay or straight. Everybody should be feel safe and on the street and in their own home.
Yeah, if only that was true. Mike, good to talk to you. Thanks very much indeed. Mike Neville there, former Metropolitan Police officer, of course. Now, just a quick reminder that Talk, the home of common sense, is going digital. Make sure you're ready, because from Monday, you can watch live on YouTube and listen to Talk on radio via DAB Plus or on your smart speaker.
Very good morning to you.
Thanks for joining us.
The home of big opinions.
Oh, don't start me on that.
Straight talking.
There's a sort of feeling they ought to look as if they're doing something.
And no nonsense.
So don't accuse anyone else of stoking culture wars.
Is going digital.
Such as the smoke and mirrors of politics.
Make sure you're ready.
But the government has got to be more flexible.
From the end of April, listen to Talk on radio via DAB or your smart speaker. Or watch live on YouTube on your connected TV.
You're watching the Independent Republican Mike Graham. Coming up next, just weeks after showing off his boxing training, the French president takes to the pitch for one of the worst penalties of all time. Weeks after a sweaty Emmanuel Macron was seen hitting a punch bag in an apparent show of virility, the French president turned his sporting attention to football this week, with wife Brigitte Macron applauding from the stands. Monsieur Macron donned his boots for a good cause, a charity match at the Stade Bernard de Giroux outside Paris to raise money for children's hospitals. Mr Macron has already shown he can handle the ball, scoring a penalty in a previous charity match in 2021, even though some critics claim the goalkeeper was a little bit obliging. This time he scored from the penalty spot once again, thanks to similarly poor goalkeeping. Let's take a look. I don't think anybody has seen a goalkeeper not move as slowly as... I mean, he just doesn't move at all, you know. I mean, presumably he's allowed Monsieur Macron to score that goal. It's absolutely pathetic, isn't it? I mean,
glorious.
I'm very much against politicians getting themselves involved in things they don't really know.
Do you remember Boris Johnson knocking over that kid?
Yes, I do remember it.
Or Boris on the zip wire.
That was hilarious. And
Boris on the
staged.
Zip wire was good.
He was very good at staging.
But he was very good at that. The panel are back with me, of course. Sam Dowler is here, Reem Ibrahim as well, and Andrew Eborn, constantly here. He's just here all the time. You know, you might as well just sit there all the time. You know, a bit like one of those guys, those American talk shows.
Still here.
Every now and again.
Like part of the furniture.
But Macron is a strange character, isn't he?
Yes.
You know, because he has this older wife. Yes. You know,
see, my friends have this theory about his wife his wife is a man.
Right.
No.
And it wasn't just a terrible
rumor. It's a right-wing theory or full of nonsense that they also said that Michelle Obama was a...
And they don't say
a trans woman, they say a man. And so, he's a man. Like, how is that an actual insult?
She used to be his teacher. She used to be his teacher.
Yeah, she did,
And that sort of thing. And it's a very sweet romantic relationship.
Isn't now, though?
Older woman, younger man, that's fine.
People didn't complain about Carla Bruni and
Sarkozy.
Yeah, Sarkozy. There's an age gap there.
Really weird and creepy.
Well, no, maybe mind your own business when it comes to somebody else's relationship.
Well, exactly.
He was a man.
I couldn't care less, to be honest. It doesn't bother me.
It doesn't bother anybody.
I'm more concerned about his inability to take a penalty.
Hilarious.
You know, because, I mean, he obviously can't be a real man if he can't take
a penalty. No, of course not.
I mean, absolutely shocking.
Of course not.
But then, I mean, you remember David Cameron pretending to be an Aston Villa fan. I came into Talk Sport, couldn't remember whether he was an Aston Villa fan or a West Ham fan, but they play in the same colours, so he was easily confused. same as old Prince William.
I like that apparently. One, because it's pretty.
Prince William claims to be an Aston Villa fan as well.
Yes.
Nobody's really very sure about that. But let's talk about some of the other stories knocking around. Captain Tom's shameless daughter, it says here, Hannah Ingram Moore, is apparently selling the family's mansion.
Yes.
Now, you might be disappointed to learn that it doesn't come with a spa, because of course they had to knock that down.
Does it come with a statue, though?
2.25 million pounds they want for a mansion in Bedfordshire. Any bidders?
Well, Beds is near... my neck of the woods, actually. And I do kind of...
Maybe you should go and have a viewing.
I would go and have a viewing just for the lols. Yeah. Because I would say, like... Is there a spa? My room said there was a spa a couple of weeks ago, but now there is not one.
And it was a spa that was built for the community, let's not forget. Oh, so, you know, you'd want to be able to...
Come on in. Yeah. It was like Lourdes. Anyone could come in and bathe in Captain Tom's ether.
Yes.
People seem to think there's a problem with being wealthy. And it's like, no, we should be encouraging people to be wealthy. We should be proud.
There's nothing wrong with being wealthy. I think there is something wrong, unfortunately, though, with using somebody like Captain Tom to raise a load of money and then give yourself some of it and say, oh, I thought that was my commission.
Bottom line is she wants to get out. She wants to get out of the house. It's got bad memories. Yeah. I mean, it was obviously, I was going to say Uncle Tom there. Was it his house or her house? I think it was their family home. Right. And obviously he has, you know, it's quite a glorious house, actually. But
it looks lovely.
But obviously, with everything that's happened, like the fact that obviously, you know, he traipses his way around to 30 million.
Does that add any value?
Yeah, but under her rule, it has become something of a white elephant, I suppose.
It's a bit like the House of Usher, isn't it?
Yes.
This would have set up
the House of Pusher.
The House of Pusher.
But he was the glorious hero, and he raised a lot of money and awareness. He was the oldest person to get to number one, which is wonderful. And Sir Tom Moore, the last thing that happened to him was
until
so
he released your
scene. But he raised money for a broken institution, the NHS. And nobody really knows. Proud of it. Yes.
Actually, nobody knows what happened to the money either, because he gave it to the NHS.
Oh, just about anything. Any kind of money to the NHS.
Apparently, they passed it on to the NHS.
No, I know that.
And then
it disappeared. No, but I'm saying, once it got to the NHS, where did it go? That's what I'm saying.
Oh, we wondered that, darling, about our taxpayer money that goes to the NHS. Yes. It's almost £200 million a year. Where's that all gone? Poor Captain Moore put in all of that effort to help people. Where did the money go?
I know.
To pen pushers.
You should also.
Yeah, but it's like when you get you get a little bit of inheritance from a granny you didn't know.
I've never had any inheritance in my life.
I know your granny.
But it goes straight into your bills. Do you know what I mean? You don't think, I must buy this.
You have a very different experience than I do. Where is my inheritance? I've never had that.
There's inheritance and there's inheritance. Because you could, if you wanted to look at this other story we've got, the Gustav Klimt painting,
which resurfaced
after 100 years. Now, believe it or not, there are cases where you find something like that in the attic.
Yes, it's
this painting is worth 26 million quid.
It's phenomenal.
Where was it found?
That would do more than pay for a few bills of yours.
It would. And you could buy Uncle Tom's house as well, and you still have change.
We could buy a nice Uncle Tom.
It's not Uncle Tom.
Captain Tom.
But 26 mil, just give it to the NHS and you'll never see it again.
I know. The NHS has an ability to swallow money. It's a bureaucratic black hole that just swallows.
But it's a bit like the government. They just want more and more money off you. Pay more tax. I don't know what the situation is if you sell a painting like that at an auction. Do you pay tax on it?
Well, the principle is it'd be capital gains tax and other bits of business. It depends on that sort of property. So, yes, absolutely. So if you got it for nothing, you had to pay tax on it.
And well, that would suck, wouldn't it? Because you'd have to pay about
this
half of
it. I believe taxation is theft, Mike.
Yes, I agree with you.
It is.
Well, I would say no taxation without representation, as they used to say.
I think that makes
sense. And we are not properly represented in this country because whenever they change the tax rules, they never ask us. Well, they never say, would you mind paying more council tax? They just put it up.
No. Well, in your independent republic, in the last dying days of it...
Pardon, Andrew.
What are you talking about?
Have some respect.
It's dying. No, we're moving.
We're moving.
It's like saying, you're moving house. It's like saying you're dead. What's wrong with you? You know?
But my point is, that is
what happened to Captain Tom, however.
He
did die in his home.
He did.
But now, Mike's not dying in this home.
No, absolutely.
Exactly. So enough.
Exactly, stop that. But I'll tell you who is dying on his arse, and that is Humza Useless.
Who started
his political career with so much promise.
Yes.
And when he came into power, unelected, of course, when Nicola Sturgeon decided that she didn't actually have anything left in the tank, he decided that he'd do away with their net zero targets, right? And then today, Patrick Harvey, the Green monster of Holyrood, has said, right, well, we're not going to support you anymore. So he's now running a minority government. Yeah. I'm told by the end of this month possible, sorry, by the end of May, he might have to have an election.
Yes. Well, if the vote of no confidence goes through, then he'll be gone. What I find really interesting is it's effectively up in Scotland, you've got socialists saying you're more socialist than me, or I'm not socialist enough, and it's all, it's basically two multiple different socialists with the, that are effectively the same, but just wearing different colour ties, and arguing with one another about who's more woke.
I almost feel like we need a general election. It's almost like the last time we had a general election, there was a completely different political landscape in Scotland, Wales, everywhere in the UK. So it's time we ask the people what they want.
Well,
the
but what's that going to change? I mean, what difference is there between the two main parties?
The problem at the moment is no matter where you are, whether it's Scotland, Wales, England, or even Northern Ireland, everybody's fed up with the government. Over in Northern Ireland, they've got a government which actually wants to unite Ireland.
Yes.
So they want to end the subject of Northern Ireland altogether. Up in Scotland, the SNP don't want independence anymore. They're just literally clinging on. And they'll probably end up getting kicked out of office. The Tories have finished in England. And in Wales, they hate Labour.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's a complete... It's
time for the independent Republic of Mike Graham.
Well, I mean, it was going to go on forever.
A benign dictatorship is the only thing that works.
I'd vote for you, Mike.
I know you would.
We all vote for you. I'm very disappointed you haven't shown the video because I was really hoping we're going to have this story.
Humza falling off the air.
Well, you have it.
Well, the one where he said, we have that for Plank of the Week every single week. In fact, he was on it last week.
I know, I remember, I loved it.
But yeah, unfortunately, we haven't got that for you, but we can probably find it.
Well, I'd like to have it.
Before the end of the show.
But
seriously, I mean, you know, there is a kind of, there's a huge vacuum at the heart of every government in the British Isles.
Right? And also, I mean, just specifically with Scotland, since we're talking about that, minimum alcohol pricing. The government have effectively, over in Scotland, implemented minimum pricing and then fudged the numbers to pretend that it's now working, that people are drinking less. It's just actually not true. They're completely making this up.
They're not drinking less, they're just dying younger.
Exactly. And then what's really interesting about this, and again, I can go on about the nanny state and A, why is it the government's business how much we drink anyway?
Yeah.
But B, the fact of the matter is the government is just making this stuff up. And now you've got the tobacco and vapes bill, which is just being passed through Parliament. And they are then effectively saying that, you know what, even though you become an adult at 18, you're not going to be allowed to make your own choices about your own body, which is absolutely bizarre. And then you've got a whole swathe of regulation on housing or how high our tax burden is. So tell me what is conservative about this.
They're wasting time with the they think it's a vote winner, I suppose. What would have been more of a vote winner would be to deal with assisted dying, for example, if they'd have talked about that or about
But those are kind of niche little things off to the side.
What's more niche?
Inheritance
tax, for example, as well. Another vote winner, except no, it's going to be cigarettes. I've never seen a 16-year-old smoke a cigarette.
This is a really good point. Inheritance tax is really, really cheap. It doesn't cost the Treasury that much.
It only cost them $7 billion. And all the people who think they're not in the categories, if you have your home now, you can buy an Uncle Tom's. You can buy his one. That would be huge on that.
But it's
sort of
because
basis.
Of fiscal drag.
It's crazy.
Due to inflation.
Get rid of
inheritance. Due to inflation, this is fiscal drag. People are now being dragged into higher income tax brackets.
Yes.
And now the people that were once entirely exempt from inheritance tax are now having to pay it. So effectively, it's death
issue,
tax, isn't it?
Isn't the issue more, though, that we're now separating the society that we live in, where there's people over here that pay tax and there's people over here who pay no tax.
Yeah.
And that's the problem. And it's two groups of people.
And it's entirely unfair. Why are we paying for people to sit at home on their bottoms?
Exactly right. Just going back to Holyrood, though, for a minute, some people think this is a good thing for the SNP because they finally got rid of the Green Party, who were so sort of crazy and extremist about a whole number of different things, including, I mean, they wanted to completely just abandon the oil and gas.
And also, I mean,
they want to break down all the businesses. They didn't want anybody riding, cutting cars.
And they're fundamentally anti-business. Yeah. They would rather we all be living in shacks and not using up any energy at all. What I find really difficult about
that would be better for the environment, FYI.
It would be better for the environment, but what progress would humanity ever make?
Well, if you want to live in a cave, you're welcome.
Volunteer.
Don't bother turning on the electricity. Just go.
Does it have a toilet?
But the really sad thing is that people are not voting in a positive way. It's always negative at the moment, isn't it? There are no true leaders, that's what they're saying.
Yes.
And that's what they need to unite.
I don't think it actually helps the fact that they're not elected.
Yes.
You know, Rishi Sunak, not elected by the people. You know, Humza Useless, not elected.
Sunak was
the
not
same
only...
Vaughan Gething.
Well, exactly. But Sunak was not only not elected by the general public, but also rejected by his own party members.
He was doubly unelected. Even his own party said, no, we'd rather have Liz Truss, and then that And that went tits up.
And everyone said,
and all we did was
and
have
everyone said at the time, oh, nobody could be worse than Liz Truss. He's actually been worse.
Yes.
Because he's actually lost more
money on it.
And there's been more of a run on investment in this country.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's been even less growth than there was in the short time that she was in.
And look,
and he's a billionaire. So how honestly would he even know
so who
how
do
we
people
live?
Respect? Who would you respect as a leader?
I don't respect any leaders.
Oh, there you
I'm
go.
My own leader, thank you very much.
Yeah, I agree. I respect the individual. I think people should have the freedom
to do
people,
what they
wish
for their
own
the government
life.
To run the country as if they were civil servants, as if they were, in fact, people.
That's why you and I disagree. I don't want the government to run the country.
Yeah.
I want them to stay out of it.
I don't want them to tell me what I should do in the bedroom, what I should do in the kitchen, what I should do in my car.
Okay.
I mean, I want to get the hell out
what
of my life.
What are you going to do in your car?
And just run. Well, they can do a lot of things in my car.
Same as he gets up to in the bedroom.
Yeah. It's a very fast car, so I can go very fast. The point is, I don't want them to take over my life. I want them to just manage the economy and make sure that people pay as little tax as possible, make sure that actually people can make businesses work and give the freedom of financial security to people.
Power
instead
to the people.
Instead of giving people free money, you know, which is ours, basically.
Yes.
I want to
there's no such thing as a free
land. Well, this is the thing. Like, we were talking about the trains earlier. Like, the country is not running correctly.
No.
On any level. It is. I know we talked about broken Britain, like, years ago. I remember, like, with Tony Blair years. Oh, it's broken Britain. Then it was, like, and then it was, you know, rural Britannia, et cetera, et cetera. So these things, you know, these things are
they
cyclical.
Do come in
these
cycles.
Things are cyclical. Yeah. Of course they are. So, like, so therefore, like, we were about to have a new government, which we know we are.
But the bad news is the governments are getting bigger with every year that passes, and the Labour Party won't be. And yes, but let's talk about something else, because I like this story. Plans for a seafront development in Portsmouth are leaving nudists. It says it's shriveled with fear.
I know. That's glorious.
These are things that you don't ever want to encounter, right?
No.
One of the worst things you could ever do is stumble upon a nudist.
When you go on holiday and you go around a secret cove,
you come through, suddenly it's
Saggy
nudist, nudist beach.
I said, lovely story, because they're talking about people, the new development, they think they're going to be shocked by seeing all these wrinkled bodies. And
no, so what I think is really lovely about this is that we end up appreciating people for who they are and actually really seeing real beauty.
What?
How
have you seen the picture?
Sorry, I was going to say...
have you looked at that?
Sorry, when you go to a nudist beach...
It's not Sports Illustrated
talking about here. I think there's beauty in everyone, Mike.
Of course you do. And that's a lovely thing to think. But unfortunately, it's not true.
It's not true. And people who go to nudist beaches tend not to be the people you want to go to nudist beaches. Would be.
I know. Can we get some nice
models in? Who's playing, like, table tennis? What's that about? Why would you want to play table tennis in the nude?
Because these are people that have, obviously, they have enough self-confidence. They're like, it's not about being naked. But, of course, you're not going to see body beautifuls on there. Because they're not the sort of people...
But they're real people.
Because the body beautifuls are busy doing something else.
As Bernard Manning would always say...
Bernard Manning.
One person had a stroke. The other
it's another Uncle Tom
that
reference.
Bernard Manning. Exactly.
I mean, for God's sake.
Goodness me, you're 2 foot away from being on that nudist beach, Andrew.
I'm 2 foot.
We can see your saggy balls from here.
I think that's enough about nudists. I've obviously sent them all insane. Now, coming up tomorrow night, 7 p.m. only here on Talk TV. It is, of course, Plank of the Week. Here's a snippet of what you can expect. I think we've got a little clip which is an example of the speed limit and how it should be done. Now, this is what... this is what the Welsh are doing.
Was that a lawnmower?
Have another look. I'm not sure if it's a lawnmower or one of those disability
scooters. Yeah,
a
mobility scooter.
Yeah, it might be a mobility scooter that's been souped up. It is. It is a mobility scooter. Here we go. Which also presumably doesn't have a registration plate, so they can't do him either. Can't be done because there's no registration plate on a mobility scooter. So,
but there's also no protection if you have an accident.
Flying
off.
Yeah, well, that's fine. Some people like danger.
People
in America who voted for freedom, they ride around on motorcycles. They used to in California without crash helmets because they want to.
Yes.
And if they want to, that's
with their AK-47s.
Yeah, they can have that as well.
Let them be free.
Let them be free with guns and no helmets. You're watching The Independent Republic of Mike Graham. Sam Smith has been announced to perform at the Proms this year. The BBC have insisted that their show will be entirely appropriate. What do you mean their show? You mean his show will be entirely appropriate for the festival. So who's going to blink first? We'll just see. Welcome back. You're watching The Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk TV. Now it's time for this.
The World of Woke.
Who can forget the black shiny rubber suit or the high neck barber's cape and huge platform shoes or the devil worshipping stage show complete with horns or the S&M inspired music video which included two X's taped over his nipples? We can, of course, only be talking about pop star and fashion icon Sam Smith. Because, darlings, he's all the rage this year, especially with his signature handbag, the Prada Clio, which retails for around 2,400 quid. Yes, my little petal, Sam the man is so popular this year that he's going to be performing at the proms. And everyone is very sure he'll tone down the controversial costumes for an older family audience of Radio 3 listeners. Quite why the BBC thinks the inclusion of Sam Smith, who once had the biggest selling debut album of the decade with In the Lonely Hour in 2014, to the proms is anyone's guess. They must be desperate for a bigger audience, I suppose, because they've also given a spot to Florence Welch from Florence and the Machine. Sam, who declares himself to be non-binary and prefers to be known as they-them, has been cutting quite the dash lately with his outrageous fashion sense, makes a change from dressing up as the devil, I suppose, and lately his clothes are all he can talk about. Here's what he says. I never thought Vivienne Westwood clothes were for me. And then recently, I just can't stop wearing Westwood. I love it. Not sure he's allowed to call himself I, but what do I know? I remember him from the days of lockdown when he photographed himself weeping inside his £12 million mansion in varying stages of self-isolation. He didn't garner much sympathy for that. And for those of you with a sensitive nature, though, we are assured that there will be no such outpourings of emotion on the stage at the Royal Albert Hall in August. It will be nothing like his raunchy performance at the Brits last year when Ofcom got over 100 complaints about the overtly sexual nature of the show. No such luck. Sam Jackson, the director of Radio 3, said, I think what you'll see is a performance that is entirely appropriate for the proms and the audience in attendance. The focus will be on Sam Smith and their music and the unique orchestral arrangement and the fact that this will be the only opportunity to see Sam Smith in the UK this year. I suppose we should all be thankful for small mercies.
The World of Woke.
Well, hopefully they're not going to let him loose on Land of Hope and Glory.
Oh, that's brilliant.
In a rubber S&M suit.
Let them loose. And Sam, no matter what you think, Sam has a beautiful voice. And
I don't like it.
And people, but people who were fans before, and fair enough, they are pushing the boundaries now with their music and their look.
There are multiple people.
He's got several personalities.
You can use them as a single.
You can use they.
As we all absolutely. Do every single
I think
day,
that's right.
FYI.
If you don't know somebody's gender...
And their gender is non-binary.
And you're right, it's like the pronoun for chocolate, like her, she, you work on that sort of basis, is always good. And the ninja.
I tend to use a singular pronoun for a singular individual, but there we are. Let's talk about what's in the papers. Gigs to be a dad again at 50. This is his third child, first with Zara, who's his girlfriend. He's going to be a dad for the third time, age 50. Not particularly old to be a dad these days.
It's not.
And his girlfriend's only 14 years younger than him, which is not very old.
And she's already a mother.
Well, Robert De Niro is 80 and Al Pacino's 84. And they're really
I think that's getting on a bit.
That's all right.
They're not even able to lift
Charlie Chaplin was 90.
But look what happened to him. But, you know.
And he died.
Wasn't allowed to speak.
I'm amazed. And honestly, if I could get it up when I was 90, fantastic.
Well, there's a thing called Viagra. You can buy that. Have you not heard of it?
I have heard of it.
Yeah.
You've certainly heard of it, haven't you?
Of course.
I'm not 90, so I don't need it.
You're a big fan.
Not yet. Max and Spencer.
Yes.
Front page, the page 3 of The Sun. New burger salad has more calories than a burger. Well,
I just know this is going to absolutely set
off. It's a burger salad.
Why would you want a burger?
What is it?
Why would you want a burger salad with burger sauce?
Cheeseburger pasta salad.
People might want to eat that, but I just know this is going to set off all of the nanny status. Well, they're going to want this to be banned, or they're going to want it to be restricted, or they're going to want it to be in plain packaging. I just know that this particular story is going to absolutely set off all the nanny status. I'll tell you what, if you want a burger salad, you should be able to have a burger salad.
But there are some foods that I think... I mean, if you want to have a burger with salad, fine. But what the burger salad, it seems to me, it seems ridiculous.
And it's a cheese burger salad, it's like putting
chicken tikka on a pizza.
Yeah.
It's not right, is it?
But what makes it a salad? Well, what's the definition of a salad? Because the whole idea, it sounds like this is pasta and it's got cheese.
I don't think it's got any lettuce.
It's got no lettuce. I would have thought a salad has lettuce.
Not like Marks & Spencer's.
People at home will know what the definition of a salad is.
LGBT sandwich, which was a BLT with avocado.
Oh, look at you with your avocado. I love a bit of avocado.
Avocado.
Guacamole, Sally, sorry, that's the G. The G was my
avocado is probably the most woke vegetable.
It is. This is quite expensive as well, probably, because it's M&S, but they've got 33 grams of fat in it, 755 calories, which is more than an actual double cheeseburger. Oh. It is a double cheeseburger with lettuce and a salad.
Good.
It's, tell people they have a choice,
brilliant.
Don't they?
It's burger sauce flavoured mayonnaise.
Well, it's called Viva. Please. Viva, which is a great name
burger sauce mayonnaise
a salad.
In itself.
Well, it is, isn't it? It just mixed the tomato ketchup and the mayonnaise. Yeah. Feud over Taylor, Inside the Sun.
Yes, we love Taylor Swift.
23 and 24, I think.
So this is a 10-year feud that's been going on.
Versus Taylor Swift.
Yes, Tay-Tay will win.
Yeah.
Tay-Tay will win.
She will.
She will. She will win. No, 200 million.
Yes,
200 million.
I watched something the other day. You know, the rapper Machine Gun Kelly.
Yes, we love Machine Gun.
So he was on a show and they asked, and the presenter asked him to say three bad things about Taylor Swift, and he refused.
Did he?
Good for him.
Because he'll get attacked.
Because he was like, I don't want that beef.
Well, funnily enough, I was talking to Kinsey Schofield earlier, and Meghan Markle has got one of the Kardashian sort of satellite members of one of the Jenners holding up a tin of her jam. And I said, well, that's bad news because now she'll be the enemy.
Yeah. All the Swifties will come after Meghan Markle. That will be the downfall of the royal family.
I'll tell
you that. What's really interesting about this feud is it's been going on for about almost a decade now.
Right. And it dates back to when Kanye West was horrible.
Sort yes.
Of. Yes.
Well, Kanye West effectively.
Oh, yeah. Back in the day.
One of the most important moments in pop culture history is Kanye West on stage with Taylor Swift and completely shocking the world. I think I felt goosebumps. I felt there was an earthquake as this was happening.
Sarcastic.
No. Me being sarcastic? What? And it was really interesting. So, yeah, so this entire feud kind of got off the back of that. Kim has been taking selfies with Taylor Swift's ex-best friend, posting it on Instagram. Now, very helpfully, The Sun has put out a lovely timeline that details every...
That's good for people like me who
people
don't know
that have absolutely
story.
No idea about what's going on. It's a very good timeline.
People like Mike with a life who wouldn't care about any of this.
I don't mind Taylor Swift's music.
Been cranked up so that they can, so that people can sell magazines and sell papers. Like, oh, I want to hear about the feud. I mean, like, nobody really cares.
Oh, I wouldn't be surprised.
Well, though, she has written a song about it, hasn't she?
The whole album.
What's really interesting is her political influence, because now the younger generation, so back in 2018...
They all want to vote for Trump now, don't they?
But that's the thing. So what's happening now is Taylor Swift will have an influence, and the younger
if she does choose to pick a candidate.
Yeah, she came out. There was a Trump. She was pictured on the carpet at the Grammys holding a Trump one thing, which was deep fake. It was a deep fake thing.
So she wasn't pictured.
So you just said something which is entirely untrue. Get off. You're finished. That's all from me tonight. You've been watching the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. Plank of the week coming back at 7 o'clock tomorrow. See me next week on Monday from 6:30 in the morning. Breakfast. It's only on Talk TV. Thanks to all of you guys. You shut up for a while. See you later.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.